The Tom Woods Show, episode 2235.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey, everybody. We all know it is time for us to break up, but everybody's status quo bias is standing in the way of this obvious and humane solution. Check out my brand new ebook called National Divorce, The Peaceful Solution to Irreconcilable Differences, which you can get for free at nationaldivorce.com. Hey, folks, Tom Woods here. Dan McCarthy, editor of Modern Age, is with us today, and we're going to try and make sense of the midterm elections. What the heck just happened here? It's not necessarily what people expected, to put it mildly, and I'm trying to understand what's going on. So, Dan, welcome. Good luck, I guess I'll say to you.
Thanks, Tom.
All right, because you have a heck of an assignment here to try to figure out what all this means. Fetterman winning? I mean, I guess, you know, I know Dr. Oz is not the ideal candidate, but to say Fetterman is not the ideal candidate would be rather an understatement. We've got all kinds of things going on. Obviously, most people were expecting some kind of red wave. I mean, there were some cautionary notes in the days leading up to the election, but I think it's safe to say that most people, you and me included, presumably, expected the Republicans to do a lot better. So, what do you think happened? I know there are a lot of people who will say it must be fraud. That's the only explanation for this. I don't rule that out, but that's never my initial go-to.
No, my impression is that American politics is entering a period of maximum entropy. So if you think about it, in 2016, everyone expected that Hillary Clinton would win, and of course she didn't. In 2020, the Democrats looked at the polls. They were absolutely certain that not only were they going to beat Trump in the presidential election, they thought they were going to have a massive blue tidal wave when it came to controlling Congress. And they were extremely disappointed by the results of the 2020 election. They looked at the narrowest congressional majority, you know, in basically post-war history that they wound up with. And they said, this is the best we can do amid COVID, amid all of these crises that the country was experiencing in 2012. And we still can't get a solid majority in the House. And of course, they didn't get a majority at all in the U.S. Senate. They got a 50-50 Senate with Kamala Harris being the deciding vote. Well, now this year, the Republicans have experienced the same thing. They went into the election with very high hopes, and those hopes have been disappointed. And again, I think this is a sign of entropy. It's a sign of just how philosophically and institutionally disorganized our politics is at the moment, that there's really no clear direction, no clear leadership. Donald Trump had a chance to provide that during 2016, then as president. Of course, there were a lot of missteps when he was president, a lot of bad appointments, people like John Bolton, for example, as national security advisor. And so as a result, people are not sure what to make of the Republican Party these days. Is it the old George W. Bush party? Is it the Mitt Romney party? Is it the party of Ron DeSantis or the party of Donald Trump? People are confused and they don't have a clear identity here. And they look at the Democrats and they have, I think, the same questions. And so even though the Democrats are coming out of this much better than they expected when they went into the midterms, the Democrats don't have any kind of commanding majorities here either. And so it's a time of entropy. And I think the opportunity for someone to come along and clarify American politics in the next 2 years or the next 4 to 6 years is really, you know, a sort of golden ticket. But it's got to be someone who's both disciplined and creative. And that's a rare combination in politics.
Right, right, right. First, before we get into any specifics, I just need to say something about the Democratic platform. Maybe you saw this post of mine. I had it on Facebook, but also Twitter. I wrote this. The Democrats ran on a bizarre, anti-human, anti-science, pro-impoverishment platform in the wake of 2 years of useless voodoo against COVID. Any sensible country would have beaten them back brutally such that they would never be heard from again. I think it's hard to disagree with that, and it is hard for me to come to terms with just how radically different the worldview of so many tens of millions of my fellow Americans is, that you would look at the Democratic platform and say, yeah, that's what I want, impoverishment and crazy gender theory nobody had heard of 10 years ago, but now it's mandatory that you believe it. Yeah, this is exactly what I want. That's inconceivable to me.
I share your incredulity here, but on the other hand, I think what many voters who are not already totally alienated from the Democrats and were not already supportive of the Republicans, what a lot of many voters who are still making up their minds or rather muddle-headed must have had to think about is, are the Republicans really offering a clear alternative to all of this? It's great that the Republicans are not endorsing this insanity, but how, for example, were Republicans going to fix something like inflation? Obviously, one of the top issues, maybe the most important issue on voters' minds. And Republicans were very good at saying inflation's a big problem. Inflation is something that the Democrats have inflicted upon us. But they were very bad about saying, okay, here's how we're going to get the Federal Reserve under control. Here's how we're going to get spending down. The Republicans really didn't want to make a clear case of their own. They instead wanted just a horror on the part of the American public towards the Democrats and towards Joe Biden to automatically elect the Republicans. And this is, of course, the same kind of mentality that the Democrats had in 2020. They thought that if Americans were alienated from Donald Trump, if they were upset about Donald Trump, that they would just automatically give the Democrats a huge legislative majority in the House and Senate. And voters actually wanted the Democrats to make more of a case for themselves. And I think Republicans wound up in the same sort of position this year. They were complacent. They thought historically the opposition party always does well in the midterms. And so they didn't think they had to make a case for themselves. They thought simply having a negative case against Joe Biden and against the Democrats and against this horrible inflationary economy and rising crime, that all of that would just automatically do the work for the Republicans. I actually wrote a piece for the New York Post about this just today.
By the way, I've been reading your pieces in both the major New York newspapers. I'm very, very glad to see all the Dan McCarthy exposure going on out there. That's really outstanding. It's interesting. We'll get onto specifics in a second. But again, with this platform thing, it's not like it's officially in the Democratic Party platform that we're going to impoverish you. But it's interesting to contrast what the Democrats are more or less saying with what they would have said 20 years ago. Progressives would have said that we're going to improve the standard of living of the most vulnerable people. Now it's quite clear they're clearly targeting the standard of living of the most vulnerable people. I heard, you know, our friend Gene Epstein has a debate series in New York, and he had a debate recently on climate change and on what the correct policy toward it should be. And he had one person who was, you know, very, 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 very concerned about extreme outcomes that were possible from this. And he had somebody else who was not as concerned. That somebody else was actually from the Obama administration, quite interestingly. But anyway, this first person was asked in the Q&A period, well, take a country like Bangladesh. I mean, they're pretty poor. I mean, what is their per capita income is between $2,000 and $3,000 a year. Are you saying that even they would have to all buy electric cars, you know, which would be 20 times what they make in a whole year? And he said correctly that, well, they're not really buying that many cars at all, but yeah, maybe we'll have some kind of international aid for them. International aid for each of these people to get, I mean, this is inconceivable. So he was frankly saying, yeah, they won't get a chance to develop. Just flat out, we're going to impoverish you. And it's sort of, well, you know, okay, if that's what you got to do. It's just incredible to me how much this has been accepted. Now, I don't want to dwell on that, unless you want to comment.
I do want to comment.
Okay.
Because I think something tangential that I recently heard from a friend of mine helps to explain what's going on here. It's totally mind-boggling that you have Democrats, progressives embracing a basically anti-human, pro-crime, anti-development, pro-poverty agenda, and yet people seem to be falling for it. The anecdote I want to share with you, a friend of mine who teaches a Great Books Politics program. So he teaches Montesquieu and Plato and Aristotle, Machiavelli, all of the great classic political thinkers. I recently asked this friend of mine how his students respond to these thinkers. Who do they find most interesting? Who do they engage with best? And his answer surprised me. He said it was Aristotle. And I thought, oh, that's great. That's a really good sign that young Americans. No, I mean, that's what he said. And I thought, hey, this is a great sign.
Right, but I thought you were going to say, but they took the worst possible lesson from Aristotle or something like that. And
no.
Taken out of your sales. Oh, good.
There is a twist to the story, though. So
Okay. Even
though they appreciated Aristotle and they were getting something good out of him, the problem was the reason they liked Aristotle, my friend noticed, was because Aristotle was giving them theory and typologies. And they liked that because they did not have enough history to understand anything else.
Yeah.
So they liked theory, but they didn't have the history to do their own thinking and to think about how theory relates to practice. And that's why they didn't like Montesquieu, because Montesquieu refers to far too many historical developments. I think this is a profound problem right now for anyone who has a sensible view of the world. We are inundated day after day with an abstract, completely false message about the world from the mainstream media, from the mainstream academy. All of this has overwritten a lot of the common sense and the historical knowledge people otherwise would have had. And Americans know nothing about their own history. They know nothing about world history. It used to be during the Cold War era that for all of the terrible things that were happening because of the Cold War, at least the Cold War forced us to be kind of serious about understanding who the communists were, understanding what it meant that they were Marxists, understanding what it meant that we were not Marxists, that we had a system of freedom here, both constitutional freedom and also economic freedom. All of this has gone by the wayside because people don't have those contexts anymore. And instead, what seems to be a governing force for so many, not only young Americans today, but even Americans who are increasingly nearing middle age, like a lot of the older millennials, is just pure sentimentality. And they really do believe and have this unlimited faith in the ability of government to do the kinds of things that you just explained, that we're not going to let Bangladesh develop, but we're somehow going to have a redistribution program that is going to provide American wealth, which of course is quite shaky in its own right. We're going to provide this American wealth to Bangladesh, and somehow we're going to provide all of Bangladesh welfare that's going to compensate for the fact that they're not going to be able to develop because of these economic environmental restrictions. People can believe this if they know no history whatsoever, and if the only theory they have is as dumbed down as possible and is as close as possible to the level of sentimentality as opposed to the level of reason. So even when my friend was saying that students respond well to Aristotle, obviously he's teaching a great book survey course. He has to cover a lot of material very quickly. And so it's not that they're getting the worst sides of Aristotle, but they are clearly only getting a taste of Aristotle as opposed to real depth. And if you only have a taste of economics or a taste of constitutionalism, you can very easily succumb to the idea, the sentimental idea, that good people have all the power they want to do whatever they want in the world. And it's like having, you know, the ring of Sauron or some sort of magic genie lamp that you can simply deploy to whatever effect you wish.
In a way, it calls to mind a point Michael Malice makes, that people seem to think that a dictator has to be somebody who is pounding his fist on a desk somewhere and shouting. You know, if the person isn't doing that, then it's okay. It's not fitting into their archetype for what a dictator would be or what somebody who is politically oppressive would look like. They expect it to be cartoonish. So now I have two points I want to raise with you to get your thoughts about. The first one's more insubstantial. The second one really gets to the heart of the matter. The first one involves Mitch McConnell. Because last night I was watching some like conservative coverage of the returns, and some people were saying Mitch McConnell has to answer for this, that we have to lay the blame for this disaster at the feet of Mitch McConnell because he deliberately pulled the plug on candidates he didn't like, who were not in the McConnell mold, who were in more of a populist mold, and now he should have to answer for that. To what extent is this just scapegoating, and to what extent is there something to it?
No, there is something to it, and Mitch McConnell was clearly very reluctant to support candidates like Blake Masters in Arizona.
Right.
McConnell would try to underfund candidates that he had a gripe with, and you know, races that are as tight as many of these were, that had dire consequences. So I certainly think Mitch McConnell deserves a significant amount of blame and discredit here, although clearly there were many other factors that were also going against the Republicans as well. I think one problem with Donald Trump, to be quite frank, is that he often favored friends, people like Dr. Oz, over candidates who might have been not known to him personally, but who could have been much more philosophically sound or much more disciplined as candidates. I think the contrast between Dr. Oz and J.D. Vance is really telling, because J.D. Vance is someone who represents many of the issues, in fact, almost all of the issues that Donald Trump really cares about. And Trump was rather slow and reluctant to endorse and support Vance, whereas Trump was very early and quite a decisive factor in getting the nomination for Dr. Oz in Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania and Ohio are both Rust Belt states, but someone young, energetic, and disciplined, and actually conservative and populist like J.D. Vance was able to succeed very well in Ohio, even up against a pretty tough Democrat. Tim Ryan in Ohio is exactly the kind of candidate the Democrats should have been running in a state like Ohio. Ohio might be a red state, but it's a state where a Democrat who has a relatively moderate profile, a relatively worker-friendly, blue-collar-friendly kind of profile like a Tim Ryan, can actually do quite well. And in Pennsylvania, what happens is you have this friend of Donald Trump, Dr. Oz, as the nominee, and he's running against a Democrat who may have serious health issues. But nevertheless, Fetterman had a public persona of being a kind of working class Democrat, a kind of someone that a down and out laid off steelworker might sympathize with just because of the way he looks and the way he talks and some of the issues he puts out there. And so Fetterman was running as kind of a left populist. Dr. Oz is running as a kind of middle-class candidate whose only claim to being a candidate is the fact that he knew Donald Trump. And I can't say that it was predictable because I was kind of hopeful that Oz might pull it off. But it has to be said, it can't be totally surprising that the left populist, Fetterman, even as debilitated as he might be, was more successful than a TV doctor who didn't even have the endorsement of his best TV friend, Oprah Winfrey.
Now, see, doesn't this show you something about significant about Trump, though? Because I've been told that Trump learned his lesson from his first term, you know, that he appointed the wrong people and this time he'll be better. But doesn't this go to show he hasn't learned a thing?
I don't know about that. I think there is a difference between your own personnel, the people you would have around you and working for you, and the way you approach giving out endorsements to your friends if they're running for public office. Now, ideally, someone who's leading a political movement should be treating the people he endorses for Congress with as much seriousness as he does, you know, the people he surrounds himself with for his own personal operation. Donald Trump, loyalty and friendship are good things. They're commendable things. They are virtues. But in politics, you also have to weigh these against reality. And Dr. Oz was not an impossible candidate, but certainly not a candidate who was extremely compelling and one who really didn't have a good reason to be the nominee in Pennsylvania this year.
Hey, folks, let's thank our sponsor, Crowd Health. You and I are different from the rest of mankind. We don't do things just because everybody else is doing them. We don't follow the crowd like lemmings. We examine each situation case by case and decide, is this the right thing to do? Or is this going to lead me into disaster? And healthcare is one of those areas where you can go dreadfully wrong by just following the crowd. CrowdHealth puts your healthcare back in your hands so you don't have to rely on big government or big health insurance companies. We all know the model in the United States is broken. CrowdHealth has a better way to fund your healthcare costs. You see any doctor you want, no deductibles, exclusions, or copays. You pay only the first $500 of any healthcare event. The CrowdHealth community takes care of the rest. And CrowdHealth helps you find great care at a fair price, always pays doctors as quickly as possible, and actively negotiates to keep costs down for everyone. In other words, it totally reverses the vicious incentives that got the American healthcare system into this mess in the first place. Take charge of your healthcare today with CrowdHealth. Open enrollment is the only time you can hit eject on the broken system without penalty, so don't wait. And for a limited time, join for just $99 per month for your first 6 months when you use promo code WOODS at joincrowdhealth.com. That's joincrowdhealth.com, promo code WOODS. CrowdHealth is not health insurance. It's a totally different way of paying for healthcare. Terms and conditions may apply.
All right, now let's get to the more substantial one. I follow Mike Cernovich on Twitter. I just think he's pretty insightful. He's not always right, but he's always interesting. And he was a big Trump guy, and then he soured on Trump. And he feels like last night was a dramatic repudiation of Trump, that it goes to show that Trump's name is just toxic, and that the success of DeSantis shows you can win decisively without being attached to him and all the baggage he brings and dwelling on the 2020 election all the time. DeSantis didn't go for that. Vance didn't go for that. They had these big victories. Let's leave Trump by the side and rally behind somebody like a DeSantis who can even flip deep blue places. What do you think about that analysis?
Well, it's tangled, isn't it? Because on the one hand, you can point to people like Oz who clearly are defeats that can be attributed to Donald Trump, at least in part. Maybe a more conventional Republican running for the Pennsylvania Senate seat this year would also have lost to Fetterman. You just don't know. But the thing that I think is missed out, if you try to blame everything on Donald Trump here, is the fact that candidates like DeSantis and especially J.D. Vance, they are candidates who owe a great debt to Donald Trump as well. And the hard right positions they've taken, more in the case of Vance and less in the case of DeSantis, but even DeSantis to some degree, they have modeled themselves after Trump, and they have adopted a more populist approach, a more restrained approach to foreign policy. All of these things have been inspired by Donald Trump. And I think if the message people try to take from the 2022 midterms is that a more conventional Mitt Romney, John McCain, George W. Bush type Republican would have been a success where Trumpian candidates failed, and that the future of the party should be retreating back to where it was before 2015, I think that would be a total misreading. What I think 2022 shows us is that you have to be Trumpian in the ways that DeSantis and Vance both are Trumpian, but it's not enough just to be Trumpian. You also have to be disciplined in the way that both Vance and DeSantis are, and you have to be willing to respond to the issue environment that actually exists around you in 2022, which especially in Florida is different from what you have perhaps elsewhere. You can't just automatically say, if I attach the Trump label and brand to myself, and if I present myself as a populist, or if I have Trump's personal endorsement, that that's going to be enough to do it. And I think this is a great lesson for Donald Trump himself, that if he's going to run again, and you know, I think he's still probably inclined to do so, he has to run as a J.D. Vance. He has to run with the degree of discipline that J.D. Vance showed. He cannot run as someone who just wants to make it up as he goes along and is relying upon his personal brand and his personal charisma to carry him through. That didn't work with a lot of other candidates in 2022. It's not going to work for Donald Trump in the future. Think back to 2016. In 2016, Donald Trump was able to win the White House with what actually was a pretty substantial set of, if not clearly articulated positions on every issue, certainly a clear policy direction. When it came to immigration, he was going to build a wall. He was going to reduce immigration. When it came to foreign policy, he was going to get us out of these Middle East wars. When it came to trade policy, he was going to put tariffs on China. It was quite clear that Donald Trump was offering something of substance, as well as offering all of the Trump bombast, which some people find thrilling and other people find repulsive. I think over time, especially as president, it was easy for Donald Trump to come to think, I'm just Donald Trump, and everything that I do is about being Donald Trump. It's not about what Donald Trump actually stands for and what he's able to accomplish. And Donald Trump is right to be proud of his achievements, but I think these sorts of positions, like especially being president, can really make you overestimate your personal brand. And if Donald Trump doesn't obtain the kind of discipline that you see from a DeSantis and from a J.D. Vance, he's going to be in a tough position if he runs again for 2024. And it's going to be a real difficulty for the GOP as well. What the GOP needs, regardless of whether it's DeSantis or whether it's Donald Trump or whether it's some dark horse yet to enter the race, they need someone who's going to be a populist, but is also going to be disciplined and is going to be able to do the kinds of things that Donald Trump did in 2016, but that more recently Donald Trump has perhaps not been quite as good at doing. That includes going out to places that had never voted Republican in a generation and making the appeal to them based on common sense and the common interests that Americans have in a strong economy, in a country that is secure and not engaged in sort of global imperial ventures. If Donald Trump can do that again, as he did in 2016, I think he can reclaim a lot of the momentum that is bleeding away from him right now. But if he's not going to have that kind of discipline, if he's not going to rise to the level of protégés like J.D. Vance and Ron DeSantis, then he really will be yesterday's news.
What do you think are some of the most interesting races? Now, I didn't follow the Vance race in the sense that I didn't know what the polling numbers said going into it. So maybe it's not a surprise that Vance won, but I still think it's significant. I've had Vance on the Tom Wood Show, as a matter of fact, and I think he's actually a pretty good guy, so I'm happy that he was elected. But what would you say are the most interesting or maybe significant of the races?
Well, some of the significant races that I've had my eye on are House races where Republicans have done much worse than expected. So Joe Kent, for example, running in Washington State, he had a very contentious primary. Joe Kent is a new style Republican. He's a more populist Republican, a Republican who's very critical of a aggressive or adventurous foreign policy. And so I had a lot of hopes for Joe Kent. But right now, as you and I are talking, they're still counting votes in Washington State. And in the early returns, Joe Kent's Democratic opponent was actually ahead of him. And that's unexpected. This was a seat that was thought to have a pretty strong Republican lean. So if he turns out to lose that race, that's going to be a pretty significant setback, not just for the GOP, but also for people who wanted to see the GOP reform and take on a new direction. You can look at a race like Lauren Boebert's House race in Colorado, and she is a Republican who is not necessarily philosophically very solid as a populist or as a new style conservative, but she is certainly a flamboyant character. And her district in Colorado was considered to be pretty darn safe for Republicans, and it looks like she has lost. So that is a surprising outcome as well. And if we look at a lot of other House races, and we look at quite a number of less high-profile Republicans, more normie Republicans, we see that they, too, have often lost their House seats or have struggled to very sort of poor victories. I think what's happening right here is that the Republican Party's brand is very unclear to voters right now, and it's very muddied to voters right now. For some voters, the Republican Party is still what it was before Trump, in the sense that it's a party of corporate America, a party that, you know, has a lot of baggage from the Iraq War and things like that. For other voters, it's the party of what they like about Donald Trump. But then for still other voters, it's the party of what they don't like about Donald Trump, a party of, you know, that they might identify with incivility or with harsh remarks about Latin America not sending its best people here and whatnot. So you've got a Trump brand that is good and a Trump brand that is bad. You've got an existing Republican brand that is more bad in many voters' eyes than good. And then you have a few people like the aforementioned J.D. Vance and Ron DeSantis, who might be developing, you know, sort of the post-Trump Republican brand, but we're not there yet. And so the question of what the Republican Party is, which of these conflicting elements is dominant, this, I think, is still unsettled in the minds of many voters. And of course, it's something where the mainstream media and other progressive institutions are constantly putting the worst possible spin and light on the Republican Party. So that, I think, explains why so many of these House races are turning out badly for Republicans of many different kinds of philosophical orientations. It's precisely because the party as a whole is having a bit more of an identity crisis, really, than I had expected, but I perhaps should have anticipated, with all these different elements competing to define themselves in different ways and based on sort of different eras, that you are going to have some confusion in voters' minds.
I want to read you a thread from Ron Coleman and have you comment on it, if you wouldn't mind. Because as I said, Cernovich is, you know, has his analysis, and he's very, very down on the results. And he says, look, don't be a Pollyanna here. This is a loss, and I want you to remember how much it stings so that we make sure it never happens again. I don't want to hear your convoluted explanations for why it's actually a victory in disguise. But here's Ron Coleman, who, granted, later on his Twitter feed says, I'll admit that there are multiple ways of interpreting what happened the other night. But he said this, such pedestrian takes being people who say this was a big loss, underselling tonight's results for the GOP. He says this, at no point in U.S. history has every single cultural institution, press, entertainment, academia, unions, public employees, the massive public employee sector, the professions, law enforcement, federal agencies, major corporations, Wall Street, nonprofits, mainline Protestant denominations, the military, I could go on, been so profoundly and explicitly aligned the way they have been behind the left in the last 5 years. There's nothing typical about this midterm election. Moreover, the GOP is bringing legitimately interesting and exciting new blood into its coalitions as candidates, young leaders, and voters. This includes many minority communities dismissed as automatic Democrat sectors for all time to come. No, not that the GOP isn't stuck with some old and stale figures, but the Democrats have no bench, no future, no one. And their party message is and will remain rooted in resentment, nihilism, division, and contempt for most Americans, their values, and their intelligence. And then you'll tell me it was only Florida. And then this is what I was referring to earlier. He continues, I mean, if you don't understand or want to accept what Florida means, the Latino vote, the economic growth, the low taxes, the nature of the leadership that transformed its political landscape, I can't help you, not at this hour. But if your response is Pennsylvania or New York or Illinois or California, it is to laugh. You're missing the forest for the trees. The 20th century is way in the rearview mirror. These states are the living dead of our republic. They're bleeding population, representation, talent, youth. New York escaped the fate of the rest of the Rust Belt by retooling as a financial center and safe tourist attraction. The quarter century of that success was mulcted to zero by Democrats in less than a decade. It's hopeless. New York is too, and so is Pennsylvania, just slower. Is that too optimistic?
I would say that's too solipsistic. So the problem, I think, with both of these angles on the election is that you have people on the right who are thinking about a country that is going to be as right-wing as they are. And they have this ideologue's fantasy that the future and the only path that the world can take is either going to be apocalyptically bad, or it's going to be the kind of world in which people who are as far to the right as we are going to be in control, and it's going to be wonderful, and voters are going to be with us always. I think this is not a realistic way to look at politics. So again, I would point to 2016, right? In 2016, Donald Trump did not write off the Rust Belt. He did not write off Pennsylvania. He went and he campaigned in places that had not heard a pro working class, a pro-Rust Belt Republican message in a generation, and he was able to win these places. And as a result of winning those places, he won the 2016 election. Now, you can't repeat the 2016 election play-by-play every year, and that's not what I'm saying. What I am saying, however, is that you need to have Republicans who are just as creative and entrepreneurial, who are just as much able to go and reach people who you would never have thought of as being your prime Republican voters, and get them to vote for you if you actually want to win. If you are writing off the Rust Belt, you're committing suicide. I mean, you have nothing that's going to replace that. And in fact, look at what's happening right now. It just blows my mind that anyone would be, if we're talking Pollyanna, yeah, some of what you read to me was Pollyanna. Think about this. Think about the regions of this country, right? It used to be thought the Sun Belt. The Sun Belt was the future of conservatism. It was Ronald Reagan land. It was Barry Goldwater land. So California, Arizona, Texas, all of these were going to be our salvation. Well, of course, California is now very much in the other camp. Texas is still pretty solidly Republican. And Arizona is a battleground. And it's a battleground that, as of the time we're recording this conversation, it's still undecided. There's still some key races there. But something is not working out the way it should have with the idea that the Sun Belt is naturally Republican. What else is meant to be naturally Republican? Well, the South, right? We've heard so much about the supposedly solid South, which was always something of a myth. But today, especially, you look at a state like Georgia, and it's clear that Georgia is not as solidly on the right as conservatives would need it to be. And yes, Brian Kemp won his gubernatorial election there, and that's obviously something Republicans are happy about, if not necessarily Donald Trump and more populist types. But the state of Georgia, if you can only elect Republicans who are relatively normie or, you know, sort of old guard, that's going to pose big problems, because the kind of Brian Kemp Republican who can win in Georgia is not going to be able to appeal to Rust Belt voters of the sort that a J.D. Vance can appeal to, or of the sort that Donald Trump appealed to in Pennsylvania in 2016. So then if you look at the Rust Belt, in 2016, Republicans for the first time opened their eyes. Republicans have been trying to win Pennsylvania for over 20 years. George W. Bush campaigned twice to really stake his bid on the idea that he could win Pennsylvania. You had all these other efforts to win Pennsylvania, and they all failed miserably. Donald Trump really did something that was remarkable there. And similarly with Wisconsin, which was also very much a battleground. And today, you know, it seems as if Republicans have not learned any lessons from the 2016 campaign that Donald Trump was successful in. Instead, Republicans are not serious about going after that Rust Belt vote. If Republicans actually want to win legislatively and also presidentially, they're going to have a multi-pronged strategy that can get to voters in all of these different regions. They need to get to the Rust Belt, the Sun Belt, and the South, and potentially other places too. And, you know, so Florida is great, seeing the great progress that Ron DeSantis has made in places where you would never have expected a Republican to do well in Florida. All of that is a wonderful precedent. And I do think it is a precedent that can, if DeSantis works very hard, be exported elsewhere. But Florida has to be a model in that creative sense. You're going to go out and actually try to get the votes you haven't gotten before. If, on the other hand, we think that it's going to be easy and that the country is naturally going to be as conservative as we want it to be, and that naturally the positions that we're offering are always going to be more attractive than the positions the other side is offering, we're going to be in for a reality check. So we actually have to be regionally conscious in our thinking about American politics. And that's one of the things that makes building a party, a successful party, a very difficult thing. But I think too many of our friends who are very strong in terms of an ideological perspective on politics are not very good about thinking about people who are unlike themselves, whose votes we may actually need in order to win.
Boy, that's very well said. I'll put it that way. That's very well said. Hey, folks, this is a message for you. And yes, I mean you, dear listener. It is so important to live up to our stated values. We're always talking about how much we believe in individual responsibility and taking care of yourself and your loved ones. Well, that means providing for them so that they'll be all right after you're gone. Your family's still going to have all the expenses you have right now, so you need to plan ahead to help them. I myself got life insurance years and years ago, and it's given me enormous peace of mind. But thanks to Policy Genius, it's easier than ever to get excellent life insurance coverage for a great price. Policy Genius was built to modernize the life insurance industry. Their technology makes it easy to compare life insurance quotes from top companies in just a few clicks to find your lowest price. And you would be shocked at how inexpensive life insurance can be if you know how to shop for it. With Policy Genius, you can find life insurance policies that start at just $17 per month for $500,000 of coverage. Your loved ones deserve a financial safety net. You deserve a smarter way to find and buy it. Head to policygenius.com or click the link in the description or on the show notes page to get your free life insurance quotes and see how much you could save. That's policygenius.com. I have a lot of people in my social media feeds today who are feeling a sense of despair. And I think what they're thinking is, if under these circumstances, we couldn't have a decisive win. I mean, after the way the Democrats have governed and behaved, and to me, the whole trans propaganda, which is unbelievable, which is dividing families all over the place. One parent wants to mutilate the child and the other doesn't. I mean, it is a mess. And you have one party that is absolutely cheering that on, like the most grotesque social revolution of our lifetimes, absolutely cheering that on, and you still can't win. What in heaven's name would it take? And I think they're feeling discouraged, and whereas I think the other side is feeling emboldened. What do we do about people who are broadly sympathetic to us who are feeling discouraged? Like, well, what's the point? If we couldn't win now, how could we ever win? Do you have anything to say to them?
Oh, sure. So first of all, I would just say that the way they feel right now is exactly the way Democrats felt in 2020, where they looked at a popular vote for Joe Biden. They looked at COVID. They looked at the feeble Republican response to Black Lives Matter and the riots and everything else. They looked at the fact that the economy was in the pits. And they said, if we can't get 51 senators under these conditions, if we can't get a really double-digit strong majority in the House of Representatives under these conditions, then gosh, we must have a very dark future. And what the Democrats did, they didn't despair. They tried very hard to get as much out of their slender majorities as they could. And they went into the 2022 midterms very clear on which issues they wanted to emphasize, very clear on how they were going to try to just limit the gains that Republicans would make. And in fact, in doing that, they've been able to limit those gains even more than they had expected. So you should always go into politics with a sense that, you know, as discouraged as you might feel, you just don't know what is going to be handed down. And you may actually wind up, if you work your hardest, you can actually get results that are better than you realistically expect. And again, this happened for Donald Trump and for Republicans in 2016. This happened for Donald Trump and Republicans again in 2020, not in the presidential election, but in the congressional elections. And it happened this year with the Democrats in the midterm congressional elections. So on that ground, never despair, always work your hardest, and always know that just doing the right thing is your duty, whether or not you expect to get a reward from it. And if you actually continue to do your duty, you have a chance of prevailing that you don't have if you just sit back and accept, you know, extinction and accept losses and defeats and just let the other side rule your life. The other thing I would say, and I do think there is a tightrope here that conservatives have to be conscious of, what you said about the transsexual issues, transgenderism, is entirely true. But notice the way in which the left has gained its perch of power with respect to this issue. They never had candidates go out there and actively campaign, like during the Obama era, for example, on transgender rights. The idea that they were going to introduce transgenderism into schools or anything like that. They didn't say a word about any of that. And in fact, as you probably recall, Barack Obama actually campaigned as a candidate who was going to uphold the Defense of Marriage Act against gay marriage and all the rest of that stuff. Democrats always campaign as quite middle-of-the-road types. At least they usually do, and that's where they think they can get their winning coalition, and they're right. What they then count on is that once they have power, they can then secretly do all these things with transgenderism in schools or whatnot. And then, if Republicans call them out on it, there's a sort of double effect. On the one hand, there are voters, especially those who've been put into these situations, who are absolutely appalled by transgenderism in the schools and the radicalism that's being forced on children. And these voters flip from the Democrats to the Republicans, or they go from being complacent to going out and actually voting Republican. But there are also a lot of voters, a huge number of voters, who just feel icky about the whole thing. And so the fact that the Democrats, even though they have a very radical agenda here, just don't talk about these things, is kind of reassuring to those voters who just don't want to talk about this, don't want to confront these things, don't want to have to look at this spectacle. Whereas Republicans, when they go out there and talk about how scandalous and awful these things are, they are getting the voters who are repulsed by it, but they're also, unfortunately and necessarily, causing voters who just want to turn a blind eye and not confront the craziness to have to identify Republicans with those who are outspoken about these issues. And like I say, a lot of people would rather stick their heads in the sand and just not know anything about it. And I think one has to take that into account. So you have to be very aware as you're talking to a large pool of voters that, you know, you need the voters who will understand the severity of this issue and why you need to vote for a conservative as a result of it. But you also need to understand those voters who just have such very sensitive stomachs that whoever talks about these things openly is going to be the one to lose, even if it's the person who's attacking this radical agenda as opposed to the one who's supporting it. Because if you support the radical agenda, but you just don't talk about it, a lot of these queasy voters will nevertheless give you the benefit of the doubt.
It's such a slimy business, honestly, isn't it? I mean, it would be better if we didn't have to do this. It's just incredible to me how little I have in common with so many of the people in the country. And this has happened just during my lifetime. I mean, yeah, I remember Ronald Reagan was a polarizing. We thought he was a polarizing figure. You know, a lot of people really didn't like him. But it wasn't like I didn't, at least when I was growing up in the 80s, have the sense that when it got right down to it, we all looked at the world completely differently. And now it's like, you know, I know you don't support the idea of national divorce, but I'm sure you can at least understand why some people feel like that's the only plausible prospect, as implausible as it is.
No, I understand it. Although part of the difficulty here is that national divorce would almost certainly have to be generational divorce as well. I don't have all the numbers of millennial voters and Generation Z voters in my mind right now in terms of how they performed during this election. But certainly the early, I think the exit poll results that I saw, first of all, they show that this election might very well have been a red wave, if not for the millennial voters. You know, that they supported Democrats to a much greater extent than older generations did. I think the Zoomer generation, Generation Z, is also, they've lived in this artificial reality their whole lives. It's an internet reality. It's a reality in which, you know, quite radicalized teachers and institutions of higher education have told them how the world works, and it's a complete lie. But I think we've got a real generational problem here and a fundamentally educational problem, even more than a political problem. That if we can't begin to reintroduce a principle of reality to people who are, you know, in their 30s and younger, then the country really won't have a future. And all of this change, I think, that has happened, again, I'm so reluctant to speak well of the Cold War, but it was a very dangerous and awful time to live through in terms of so many of the policies we pursued, so many of the risks that were being faced in terms of the peoples of Eastern Europe being dominated by communism, Russia itself dominated by communism. But at least the stakes were such that they were clear and we had to take everything seriously. We had to know our own history. We had to value our constitution. We had to value real economics as opposed to socialist economics and wishful thinking. There was something to keep us grounded. And we tended to take education, I think, a bit more seriously then. And journalists took their jobs a bit more seriously then. Whereas now, everything is based upon absolute fantasies like the 1619 Project and other anti-Western mythologies, which are promulgated so relentlessly in our educational system and in journalism that people who, you know, don't remember the world as it was before the new thing was imposed on us, before everything went down the memory hole, they have nothing as a point of reference for reality. It's cliche to always invoke George Orwell, but this really is a case where the party, which is the left, has succeeded in rewriting history to such a degree that even though people know something is wrong in their hearts, you know, they sense something is wrong, the fact that they, you know, are suffering from so many deaths of despair and that young people are suffering so much mental illness, all of this is an indication that something is profoundly wrong about the reality in which we live. You know, I'm not a big Jordan Peterson fan, but clearly his popularity and his importance is all based on the fact that he speaks to this. People know something is profoundly wrong, but because they don't know history and they don't know any kind of rigorous thought that is not left-wing thought, they are just lacking in the resources to figure out what it is that is killing them, basically.
Oh, my goodness, Dan. I don't know how to end this. I'd like to end it on a note of not complete despair, and you did sort of cover that, but this is not the conversation I expected you and I to be having today. I thought it would be quite a different conversation. And I thought Blake Masters had a genuine shot at it, actually. And there were just some poll numbers that didn't quite materialize. So it's a shame that we're not having the conversation I wanted to have. And
Well, let me say two things, though. So first of all, one part where I do agree with the Coleman column that you read earlier is that we do have a lot of young, really great talent on the right, people like Blake Masters. And keep in mind, you don't have to win your first election in order to be a significant force in American politics. In fact, early on, during the primary season in Ohio, it seemed like J.D. Vance had a really tough race on his hands. I wrote a column where I said, even if J.D. Vance loses his primary and doesn't become what people were hoping from him, he should nevertheless stay involved in politics and stay involved in sort of intellectual leadership of conservatism, because there's an awful lot you can do whether or not you win a particular election. And that certainly applies to Blake Masters as well. And in fact, I think it applies to a lot of the young talent that's out there right now. So in that sense, you should not only not despair about 2022 election results, but you should actually take encouragement. The fact that these folks were able to win primaries and put themselves in a position where they might lose the general election this first time, but they're actually gaining, you know, experience and strength and seasoning, all of that can be put to good use in the future. It's like Ron Paul, right? I mean, how many elections did Ron Paul run? He ran as a Libertarian for president in 1988. That didn't work out, but that didn't discourage him from running for president on the Republican Party ticket or on the Republican primaries in 2008, and then again in 2012. All of that was building the movement. All of that was getting Dr. Paul's ideas out there. And people like Blake Masters and others who are on the right today, who are very young. And, you know, I mean, Ron Paul was already a senior statesman by the time he was running for president, certainly when I worked for him in 2008. And he's someone whose longevity and health are still holding up very well. But imagine if he had been in his 40s or in his 30s, you know, in the case with Blake Masters, he's still in his 30s. Imagine if you're in your 30s and you get a, you know, a start in politics like this, you win a primary, you get a message out there that's energizing and dynamic. You have a huge future ahead of you. And the future is really won by the people who are most disciplined and who have, you know, the most relentless application of their ideas and also the smartest understanding of their surroundings. One of the things I would always point to for people on the right who want to be encouraged, what seem to be the darkest days, just think about how marginal all of these left-wing radical positions were 20 years ago, let alone 40 years ago, right? You would have thought that none of this crazy radicalism, nothing like same-sex marriage even, would have had any chance whatsoever of becoming the norm within the United States. And yet the left, it was always willing to be both radical, but also realistic. It was always willing to stake out the far end that they wanted to reach, while at the same time having lots of intermediary goals that they could reach in the short run. And they were never discouraged. And I would say, well, even if you lose a general election, if you still built up your power within the party, or if you still built up your power within your own movement, you have new resources that you can use in the future, and you just keep growing and growing each stage until you finally win. So that's what I think would be, should be the mentality of people on the right who are dismayed by the results of this midterm election. But, you know, there's a lot of potential in the future, especially among young leaders like Blake Masters. And then finally, I would just say, Ramo, another point I think Coleman was right about is the Democrats really are a very old party and they don't have a lot of fresh leadership. And even though they are hanging on by their fingernails, it's partly because the Democrats are still in this sweet spot where a lot of older Americans think that, oh, you know, it's Joe Biden. Joe Biden is not some radical leftist. Joe Biden is not going to introduce transgenderism into the schools or whatever. The Democrats are still able to get by as being the party of the New Deal or of JFK or of, you know, a kind of 20th century mainstream, even though that's not actually what the Democratic Party is. It's actually a very radical party. As this generation of Joe Bidens disappears, it's going to be much, much harder for Democrats to continue to make a case that they are, in fact, a party of normal people. And it's going to be more and more clear just how radical the radicals are. So there, too, I think time is on our side. There are ways in which time is not on our side, but in terms of young talent and in terms of the Democrats' sort of old branding fading away sooner rather than later, we very much have time on our side.
Incidentally, I don't know that this was done on purpose, but I always felt like when Joe Biden would use old-timey turns of phrase like malarkey, that this wasn't just a sign that he's an old-timer. That was done on purpose to connect with that class of voters. You know, like I'm kind of like one of you. You know, I say words like malarkey that no one in this, you know, some young person had never even heard that word before, that he would do things like this here and there just to, in a very, very subtle way, to signal to them that he's a, you know, an old timer like them and he loves the old America like them and he uses outdated expressions. So I always felt like that was a deliberately cultivated image to serve exactly that purpose. A little harder for AOC to go around using the word malarkey and these sort of appeals to that demographic. Well, Dan, I want to, first of all, thank you. This is longer than I expected to keep you, but you're an incredibly good sport to stay on and talk. This was therapeutic for me, and I think for a lot of people listening. And to say thank you to Dan, there are many ways to do that, but one of them is to check out Modern Age, which is the journal that Dan edits. You can find out all about it at modernagejournal.com, and you can rest comfortably in the knowledge that really, really smart and accomplished people have been writing for and reading that publication for, let's see, is it 65 years?
It's going all the way back to 1957.
How about that? How about that? So go on ahead and do that. And Dan, thanks so much.
Thank you, Tom.
And thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at Podsworth.com.